Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Joining me on Midnight in Karachi is writer and editor Kelly Link, whose previous short story collections, Stranger Things Happen, Magic for Beginners, and Pretty Monsters have been praised as wonderful, fabulous literature or magic realism, and very often just as straight-up, really good stories. She's won a Hugo Award, 3 Nebula Awards, and a World Fantasy Award as well. I'm personally a really big fan of Pretty Monsters especially, and now very much so of Kelly's latest collection, Get in Trouble. It's really great to have you here, Kelly. Welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Now, Get in Trouble is your latest collection of stories, and it's basically been received really well everywhere. You're a seasoned writer, and is there still a sense of relief or a thrill or joy to hear that people are enjoying your work?
Yes, absolutely. There's also, though, a faint feeling of foreboding. You do wait for the other shoe to drop. But then if what you want is for the other shoe to drop, you can always go to Amazon and read reviews and
right.
Find the segment that you know is there that is not really into the kind of stuff that you do, which frankly I find really reassuring.
Really? You find that reassuring? In what way?
I do. I think I don't know if it comes from a craving for balance or if it's because I've taught in workshops and gone to workshops for so long that you know that reading experiences are unique and particular to the reader. And so anytime you write something, you think, well, there are going to be people who don't like this. And I think you're a much happier writer if at least you can say to yourself, but that's okay. And I actually, what I feel is once I've identified, I think the kind of reader for whom a story doesn't work for, I feel that all is right with the world.
Do you ever identify who your readers may be when you sit down to write?
Good question. I think that I think of somebody who reads most of these stories as someone who is not necessarily reading for resolution, maybe, but who is reading for the experience of seeing things differently. And I come out of, I grew up reading fantasy and science fiction and really loving writers like Le Guin, Joanna Russ, but also horror writers like Peter Straub, M.R. James. And so when I think of sort of an ideal reader, I'm thinking of somebody who has read sort of widely inside genre and maybe will recognize riffs that I'm sort of playing off of other stories, or maybe can read a particular ghost story that I've written and think, oh, well, this is like these other kinds of stories, but here may be the changes, or here's the things that I might expect being familiar with science fiction and fantasy.
Now, I read somewhere you saying that the fantastic is a flexible metaphor. I'd read that a while ago, and I kept thinking about it when all this conversation around the new Ishiguro book began. And it couldn't be, I mean, that phrase, that the fantastic is a flexible metaphor, it couldn't be more true to me. I don't think there's any genre, any system, or, I don't know, any world that can be manipulated or remolded or created in whatever image you want the way the fantastic can.
This is something that this is something that I didn't think about until the last couple of years. It's something that sort of maybe was percolating in the back of my head, but it's the fact that the fantastic is a flexible metaphor is a good thing and a bad thing, because it means that the experience of the reader is going to be that much more distinct to them. You know, they are going to bring to any sort of let's say you put a vampire in a story. They are going to bring to that story their own ideas that come from their reading or from what they know of vampires from popular culture or from folklore. They're going to bring all those attachments with them. And they are going to, in their head, have a very particular idea of what a vampire is, which is great. I mean, it means that the story is that much more collaborative. You're pulling from other stories. And so you bring that in as well. And on the negative side, because the fantastic is so flexible and because it does require the reader to sort of bring their own associations, and also the writer is bringing their associations to what the fantastic is. There's a lot of maybe there's bias. There are really nasty sort of things that percolate up as well, which I think is some of the weird stuff when you look at science fiction or fantasy. You know, who is, if you were telling a horror story or ghost story, what are you afraid of? What is the thing that you are sort of, you know, building this idea of what is terrifying, and what is the in the story, what can the ghost or what can the monster represent? And so sometimes you get stories where the monster is a, you know, the thing that is terrifying is a woman, you know, is something that is not sort of just the sort of baseline guy in the story. So you get stories in which the other is sort of grotesque and terrifying. And then you think, well, what kind of associations are people going to attach to this? What am I attaching to it? And so you have to really work through all of those things sort of thoughtfully in such a way that what you're doing is interesting and raises interesting questions rather than conforming to the kind of cultural biases or weird sort of, you know, stuff that sort of is under the surface for the writer as well as for the readers.
Have you read the new Ishiguro book?
I have not. You know, I have read descriptions of it. I read Le Guin's very short essay about it. I read his response. And I'm now very, very curious to read it. It does sound as if, you know, I read the piece that he wrote in which he said he's on the side of the dragons. And reading what Le Guin wrote about it, I thought, well, you know, it's quite possible that I might find the sort of way in which he uses the landscape. It seemed to me that she found it muddy or sort of tangled. Have you read it?
I have not. I'm waiting to get a hold of a copy. In fact, I've been calling up bookstores all over the place because I think it's a book that I may need to read in physical copy.
Yes.
I think it's fairly long, isn't it?
It is reasonably long. And, you know, the problem I think with ebooks is that it's very, you can't flip back and forth the way you do with a paper book.
It does bother me. I won't lie. It does bother me. So I've been waiting to get a hold of it. But I'm with you on this. I think it'll be really interesting. More so now, all this talk has basically, I think, done well for his publishers. I think it's going to sell a lot more copies now.
And it is a physically very beautiful book. The cover is gorgeous. It looks like a book that would be fun to own.
Yeah. Now, from what I know, you've never ventured away from short stories when it comes to writing fiction. What draws you to that form of storytelling? And do you think you'd ever be thinking about or considering venturing into longer narrative forms?
I have agreed for Random House to write a novel. I've sold a novel. So I will be writing one. And part of the reason why I contracted to write a novel is the stories have been getting longer. Most of the stories in Get in Trouble are between 10,000 and 18,000 words. And, you know, the classic short story length is between 4,000 and 6,000 words. And I work with a group of writers in the area where I live, Northampton, Amherst. And they're mostly novelists. And they said to me, well, your stuff is getting longer and longer. You know, if you push a little bit further, you'll be in novel territory. And I started to think about it, and I thought it would be fun to continue to sort of expand rather than trying to pull things back to classic short story length, which is the direction that I kept on trying to move. I kept on trying to get things shorter and shorter and had a hard time doing it. And they said, well, push in the opposite direction. And I thought that actually sounds like an interesting thing to try. Whereas in the past, what I've always thought is, I really don't want to do that. And now, for whatever reason, in the last year, I've been thinking, I would really like to try writing a novel.
Well, that's exciting, though, and I suppose in some way scary as well.
It is very scary. I don't think I would do it if I didn't have a community of people who write novels and who love to talk about novels.
And a contract.
I have all the necessary prods.
Yeah, there's no backing out now.
No.
Do you think experimentation is less risky with short fiction for both the writer and the reader? Are people willing to take more chances with something unfamiliar? Are people willing to take more chances with something akin to what you write, which, you know, people can call fabulist or magic realist or slipstream or whatever it is, whatever label that it is that they give it?
I think that the audience for short stories, the general audience for short stories, is more willing to tackle work reading, which is maybe deviates from the norm a little bit more. You know, if you read short stories, you know that the space is not that large. Your commitment is not as big. And so I think, yes, short story readers are more willing to go along with something that feels a little stranger. But having said that, that's a pretty small audience. I think there's a much larger general audience for novels, whether they contain the fantastic or not. And I think that there are also maybe different kinds of experimentation that one can do in a novel. You have a lot more space to do interesting things with characters, maybe. I think there are ways to play around more with maybe with digressions, or maybe to I think that you can put more stuff. I mean, obviously you can put more stuff into a novel. My hope is that some of the stuff that you can put into a novel is going to be pretty weird. And I don't just mean in terms of material, but I mean in terms of approach. But having said that, I think that the reader's patience in a novel, you have to give them a pretty strong through line if you want to keep a general audience. So maybe less weirdness in terms of sentence structure, but maybe more weirdness in terms of things like how you structure point of view, or how you move between chapters, maybe what you do with time.
That's interesting what you said about a reader's patience with novels. I actually find that I have less patience with short stories because I feel myself thinking, well, this is a short story. You better show me what you got much faster because you don't have much time to do it.
And no, that's a good point.
I wonder now if I'm being unfair, though.
No, I mean, I don't think I don't know. I was going to say that I don't think that there's any such thing as fair or unfair when it comes to how we experience art or narrative. But on the other hand, I think patience as a reader, your patience may be rewarded. But I certainly start short stories in magazines and think, I already know I don't like this. And I think that's less because what the writer is doing is experimental, and it's more because I recognize what they're doing. And I think I've seen this kind of story before, and I'm not being promised anything new in it. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Now, I wanted to talk as well about themes and motifs that run through your latest collection of stories, but then I wondered if that even makes sense to talk about, because I didn't know if they'd been written within a certain period of time or whether some were much older than the others, and in a way that I guess it doesn't really matter to me as a reader, you know, or any reader, someone who gets all those stories collected together as to when they were written. But it'd be interesting to see if there were thoughts that stayed with you for a while and ideas, emotions that run through the stories, but the stories were created months and months apart.
Well, the stories in the book, I think the earliest story was written maybe 2004, I think. 2005, 2006. I think they were written over about 10 years. But I think it is a valid question, and it's something that with a collection the writer does when they realize they have a book's worth of material, you know, you sit down and you think, well, and in part you're doing that out of very practical reasons. You're thinking, when I send this book out on submission, how should it be organized in such a way that story by story it feels coherent rather than repetitive? And also how do I make sure that the kinds of thematic stuff that comes up, you know, the things are sort of that there's a flow rather than a lot of weird jostling, and you know, where instead you feel like what you got was just a bunch of stories rather than a collection. And so, I mean, that's partly where the title comes from, is sitting down with the stories, all but the last two, which I wrote after, you know, after I began to put things together, and thinking, well, these really are, you know, stories about people, you know, people with poor impulse control. And in fact, I sort of had a dumb revelation about how stories work, which is stories are about, you know, people not doing the right thing necessarily, or at least people who, whether because of circumstances or because of their personality, really are having to struggle to make the right choices. And I, you know, there are a lot of things that thematically are bumping around in the collection. There are a lot of coming of age stories, but there are also a lot of stories about people in middle age. And the one thing I will say that I noticed is that the stories about the stories where the protagonists are adolescents are, to me, much more hopeful stories. Because I think while you're young, you know, you'll get other chances. And the stories about middle-aged protagonists, you know, I'm much closer to them now. I am middle-aged. I sort of look at them and where they are in the story, and I think, really shouldn't screw this up this time. This may be your last chance. So they're much more stories in which I felt like asking the characters, are you really sure you want to do that? Which is an unfair thing to ask of a character when, in fact, you are writing the story and deciding what they're going to do.
On the other hand, if they did everything right, it would be a boring story. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, I get what you mean, but no, you need them to do the terrible things.
And because, I mean, and I think that this is, you know, that this is actually what stories are about. You know, ghost stories are about people being haunted, and often they're being haunted because they feel some kind of responsibility for something. Horror stories are about people encountering something that comes after them. And I think the impulse with a horror story is always, well, what did they do to deserve this? And in my heart, what I feel is nobody deserves any, you know, it's not necessarily a question, did they deserve this sort of extraordinarily awful thing to happen to them? But why do they feel that they deserved it? You know, what are the moments at which they can attach meaning to the thing that's happening to them? And where are the points where they sort of are attempting to escape meaning, in which they think there's too much meaning attached to my life. I think what I would like is less meaning. I'm very sympathetic to all of the characters in the collection, even the people who do kind of repulsive stuff. You know, I think there are probably points in your life where you are a good person as well. You know, this is just the thing that I'm writing about is the point where you made a mistake.
You know, there's a phrase in Urdu which means that a person is, essentially translates as somebody is good at heart. The phrase is dil ka acha, and it's often used in terms of when you're criticizing someone or saying something, someone's done something terrible or something terrible is going on around them. People sometimes justify that judgment by saying, no, but he's good at heart. Which always makes me wonder when you say this about characters, that they're ultimately good people or they mean well or whatever it is. I think at some point, pretty much everyone is good at heart, but then it is their actions and their, at least for characters, and the process that they go through in doing what they do that essentially entertain us as readers.
Yes. And it's, you know, it is that thing when you are sitting with friends and someone tells a real life story, usually the story that they're telling is about either something inexplicable that happened to somebody or else a terrible mistake that somebody made that had consequences, or maybe that didn't have consequences. And that's the point of the story is, can you believe this person got away with this thing?
Right.
And, you know, that is a source of that kind of story, I think, has an endless kind of power over us. You know, why people decide to do things that maybe are self-destructive, or maybe why people do things that are different from the kinds of things that they normally do.
Now, you've also been an editor and a publisher. You co-founded Small Bear Press, which recently came to my attention for Sofia Samatar's A Stranger in Alondria, which made it to a lot of award shortlists. Do you think being a writer helps make you a better editor and publisher as well, or does it work the other way around?
I mostly see how it works the other way around. And I think in part that's because I wouldn't want to speak for the writers that we publish and, you know, describe in any way what the experience of being edited or published by us is like. I'm sure people, my hope would be is that people have had good experiences. But what I do know is that, you know, the experience of working with other people on novels, one has taught me a lot about novels, which I hope to put to use. And the other is that to me, to be the editor and be able to come to somebody when we're working on their book and to attempt to think through the things that they're trying to accomplish in the novel, and to think maybe of other questions that might be interesting to them to pursue that might make the book richer. Maybe not make the book feel too crowded, but to think, well, here's a strand which you were pursuing, which maybe you dropped just a little bit. And do you want to tie it up neatly or do you want to leave it open? And to sort of go through and ask that kind of question that feels like a gift. And it does mean that when I am working on my own stuff, that I am, I hope, a little bit better, even with my own work, at looking for those strands and thinking, here's something which maybe I could pursue further. Would it serve the story if I followed up on it?
There's recently been some conversation online that I've been following about the need to get writing degrees, or whether there's a need to get writing degrees, or the benefits of workshops like Clarion, which you went to as well. It's obviously something that works in different ways for different people, but what's your stance on this? Would you, for example, have been the writer you are now without an MFA or without the Clarion experience?
No, I don't know that I would be writing at all. Almost all of the stories in Stranger Things Happen came out of either my MFA, my 2 years in the MFA program, or else out of Clarion. I think there are three stories maybe that I wrote after Clarion. The rest I wrote during it or in the MFA program. And I, you know, in part that's because I'm not somebody who naturally sits down and writes a story. I need to feel that there is somewhere that story is going to go, whether it's to an editor or for a workshop that I'm going to be going to. There needs to be a reason to write the story beyond just writing the story, which is kind of terrible, but that's how I work. And I also really need that sense of, or at least I get a lot out of a sense of community or conversation. And I'm not in a formal workshop at the moment, but I do meet up on a regular basis, ideally a couple times a week, with my friends here who write. And we don't just meet up and eat lunch and write. We actually probably spend half of our time talking about narrative and the kinds of things that stories do, or the kinds of character arcs that readers are attracted to. And I find that really energizing. And we then work for a bit, and then we pass our computers around and we look at what the other people have been working on as well. And that is really necessary to me, for whatever reason, to feel that I'm not the only one doing this kind of work. And I don't think workshop is for everyone, but I do think it is probably worth at least trying a workshop, finding a good group and seeing if it's a good experience. And the one thing that I will say about MFA programs is I loved mine. I think they can be really good, really useful. And the only caveat I have is the expense. And it unnerves me, the idea that somebody might spend, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 to go through an MFA program. I don't think anybody should go into debt in order to go through an MFA program.
Now, I hear you're a fan both of Buffy and The Vampire Diaries. I admit I never paid much attention to Vampire Diaries personally, other than noting how everyone in that cast always had the most fantastic coats and jackets on. But that's probably because I live in Karachi and there's never a reason to wear a coat here. So, you know, we always look at that stuff. We're like, ooh, winter fashion. How cool is that? And then we drape one small shawl over our shoulders in December.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, I also think they're obviously vastly different creatures, both these TV shows. Or am I wrong?
No, they're very different. They are telling very different kinds of stories. You know, Buffy, we're actually rewatching Buffy very slowly at the moment. And Buffy is enormously funny. It's also, you know, lots of terrible, terrible things happen in it. But it's a show about a community of people who mostly try and do the right thing. And, you know, the monsters in it are, for the most part, really bad. And Vampire Diaries is a much more gothic story in which everybody eventually is pretty much a monster. And everybody really does awful stuff. And that was the thing that sort of gave me the most pause when I started watching it, which was, these people are terrible, terrible people. I kept on thinking, well, is this the hero of the show? No, clearly not. This is also a terrible person. And I think, you know, it is a gothic, and it is a show about people who do awful things for the sake of love. It's a love story. It's absolutely a story about love, but it is not a very sentimental story, which I appreciate. You know, the things that people do for love are not good things. Pretty much everybody in the show is a terrible person. And that could be very dreary, but instead it's actually a very funny show. The plot moves along at a really great clip, and I find it enormously hard to predict the ways that the story is going to go. And I think that's part of the biggest appeal to me, is that I don't know what's going to happen next, but the things, when they do happen, it feels very coherent to me. I think, well, of course that happened. You know, that was, I should have seen that coming. But it's so fast that I'm sort of sucked along, which is very rare for me now with stories. Mostly with fiction, the pleasure is watching somebody execute a pattern in a somewhat predictable way. Maybe the language is surprising, but the patterns are pretty clear. And so it's very nice to have a story where, in fact, I cannot predict the pattern.
Are you drawn to love stories about as much as you're drawn to, say, horror stories?
I am, but I find it a little bit harder to enjoy them in the same way that I enjoy horror stories. I don't know if that's because, you know, I went through a period in my MFA program where I read a lot of romance novels and enjoyed them a great deal, but I sort of burned through a lot of the classics, and you know, now I don't really keep up with the genre, and most of the books that I pick up I find a little bit disappointing. And I think that's because that pattern is typically so predictable. And I think what I like best of all now is a stories which mix genres. So Vampire Diaries, which is a gothic, but which is also a love story. I like young adult fiction, which has a love story aspect to it, but it's not just a romance. I think what I like is stuff which mixes genres.
You've got me now thinking if I can think of anything that's a horror romance or a romantic horror. Is there something like that? I mean, my first thought was Dracula, but that's completely wrong.
Well, I think it is possible to... I mean, certainly when people retell Dracula, they often make it a romance.
Yes, which is, I mean, it's weird and worrying in lots of ways, but I guess it could, you know, if you think of it as like some sort of weird gothic romantic horror, that's a lot of qualifications I just made, but that might work.
I've been thinking about, two of my favorite love stories, which are something else as well. I really love Tabitha King's book, One on One, which I'm thinking of in part because I'm looking at a bookshelf and I see it there. And that's a coming of age story about two kids in high school, where one is a basketball player who fall in love. And it's kind of a gothic, you know, really terrible things happen. But at heart, it's also a story about two people falling in love. And I really love Peter Straub's Shadowlands, which is in some ways a story of a magician But it's also kind of a weird love story. It's not a love story with a happy ending, but it is a story about somebody falling in love. I love Ann Patchett's novel, Bel Canto, which is very much a love story, not a happy one. But it is in some ways a consolatory love story.
I think maybe some of Angela Carter's stories would, from The Bloody Chamber might fall into that category.
Well, absolutely. And I think maybe, it's I maybe we can make a little bit of a distinction between stories which are love stories and stories which are about exploring, I guess, feeling and sensation and the experience of being maybe obsession with somebody.
Right.
One is a very romantic kind of story. One is sort of, I'm not going to say it's just a story about sex or about the physical, but is sort of pushes into a slightly different realm. And I actually really like both of those kinds of stories. I think they are absolutely connected to each other. I think one is romantic, though, and the other is a little bit more hard-headed.
Now, one last question, Kelly. When's the novel out?
I have a couple of very tiny fragments, and I have some ideas. It's really I sold the novel. I then had a lot of work to do on the last two stories for the collection, and now I'm back from tour, and I should really start working on the novel pretty soon. And so it's an enormous relief that I have some ideas about what I want to do. And so I'll have to see if I can actually pull off those ideas.
Ideas are good.
Ideas are great.
Well,
I'm ecstatic to have them.
I hope you come back here on Midnight in Karachi and speak about the novel when it's out.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It was really lovely speaking with you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kelly Link on Midnight in Karachi, Kelly's new collection of short stories, is out now. It's called Get in Trouble. Under the Radar on Midnight in Karachi. Today I'll be talking to Becky Chambers, a writer whose work has appeared at a number of places, including Tor.com and The Mary Sue, and who has very recently gone from having a self-published novel to an award-nominated novel to being picked up by UK publisher Hot Escape. The novel, of course, is The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, and you may have heard some buzz about it already. Not just does it have a terrific title, it's also a really warm, fun space opera with a great set of complex, interesting characters. So, so charming and just so very human in so many ways. Becky, welcome to Midnight in Karachi. I'm so pleased to have you here.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here too.
Now, the last few weeks sound like they've been really, really exciting. What's that been like for you?
It's been completely bewildering in a very good way. When I put this book out there initially, I self-published in July, and I figured that was it. I got a decent following of readers, and people seemed to enjoy it. But I figured that was it. I was like, okay, that was a good first step. Now I'll figure out what the next thing is, and I'll put this one to bed. So the offer from my publisher and the news about the Kitschy shortlist, that all happened within 2 weeks. So I'm still pinching myself. It's really wonderful, and I'm very grateful, but it is incredibly surreal.
Now, there's always a discussion to be had about self-publishing versus traditional publishing. Some people have very strong views on either or, both things. I personally don't think there's any one rule that applies to everyone. Self-publishing is obviously something that worked out well for you. What was your reason for going in that direction and for using Kickstarter to get your novel together?
I actually initially was going to pursue traditional publishing and did head down that path at first. The Kickstarter was my jumping off point. At the time, I was still freelancing, and I had finally started work on the book, which I had wanted to do for years, and just hadn't taken the plunge yet. And at the time, I had run out of paying work. I had some stuff lined up for a few months down the road, but I was high and dry. So I said, okay, either you need to take this time to, keep pitching, looking for new gigs, or you need to figure out a way to actually get this book done and eat. So I turned to Kickstarter, and it wasn't just about the money though. It was also I wanted to see if this was something that people were actually interested in. It was my litmus test. It was putting it out there and being like, okay, is this something people want to read? And if not, that's probably a good sign that I need to go do something else. But people apparently were interested and got me going. But in the campaign, I said at the start that I was going to pursue traditional publishing. And I did. I got an agent and we started that whole process. But my agent went on to bigger and better things. He got a new job. And so I was left with this big question of what do I do next? Do I keep querying and keep putting things out there, or do I just go it on my own? And since I had this posse of backers who had been so patiently waiting and so supportive, I figured that I owed it to them to show them what they'd helped to create. So, and it was very empowering for me actually to be able to say, okay, this path didn't work out. I have this other option instead. I think that's a really wonderful thing that writers have nowadays, that we have so many different options.
All right, so are you completely satisfied with the self-publishing option?
Yeah, I think so. It was a really positive experience for me. It was a ton of work. I think the traditional publishing, self-publishing question really comes down to what you're most comfortable with, what your strengths are. I think traditional publishing is really great for people who just want to focus on the writing side. Self-publishing required me to stretch a lot of muscles that I wasn't accustomed to, self-promotion being the biggest one. You know, you spend a lot of time doing things like, you know, just formatting text files and you know, setting up websites and all these things that aren't you don't tend to think of when you're like, oh, I'm going to write a book. But I really enjoyed that part of the process. I really enjoyed having to learn all these different skills and to get out of my comfort zone and to find that I could do it on my own. It was a very satisfying process.
And then when the deal with Hodder came through?
It's still completely bizarre to me. Yeah, I mean that really came out of the blue for me. It wasn't something that I was pursuing. And I spent a lot of time thinking about whether or not it was something I wanted to do, because I had sort of put that book to bed, as far as I was concerned. I was done with it. And then it was, you know, this reopening it, let's push it out there a little bit further. But everybody at Hodder has been so, not just warm and welcoming, but so supportive of the book, and they really understood what I was trying to do with it, what I was trying to say. And so it felt right. It felt right to give it a new home and to hand the reins over.
And they've got a really great cover for it now, haven't they?
Oh, it's beautiful.
It
It's
really is.
absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I was very happy with my first cover as well, and that was such a delight to work on with my cover artist. But I do love the new cover. It's stunning. I'm very happy with it.
Now, I've really enjoyed The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. I actually bought the ebook when Jared Schoen mentioned it on a podcast we did for Rocket Talk on Tor.com, and he went on and on about it, and I had to read it then. But would you tell us a little bit about how you came about the premise, this idea of a motley crew, literally a crew on a little ship digging tunnels through space and time, and they're hiding secrets and forming bonds and learning and living together?
I grew up with space opera. You know, I grew up on Star Trek and Star Wars and all the rest of it. So the idea of an intergalactic community is something that has always appealed to me. It's something I've spent a lot of my life thinking about, and a lot of my life imagining myself in. And the thing I've always had to come back around to is like, well, but I'm not a hero. You know, I wouldn't be the protagonist in one of those stories because I'm not that brave. So I would always imagine myself as one of the people in the background. You know, when the camera's focused on the protagonist going wherever they're going, the people who are in the background loading things onto ships, walking through the shuttle bay, those are the people that I was always most interested about. You know, what would it be like for ordinary people, you know, your average Joe, living in one of these, you know, larger than life intergalactic communities? What would it actually be like for someone who just lives there, who's just on the fringes of all these bigger things happening? So that was the story I wanted to tell. Something about, you know, here's this galaxy. And it's one that I think, if you're a fan of space opera, you're kind of familiar with that sort of premise. You know, you have all these different species, and they've got all these political connections with each other. But the story doesn't focus on that. That's the news, you know. So what is it? What's the everyday like for people living there.
That's one of the things I really enjoyed about the book. I'm not a massive fan of reading space opera. I am of watching it, as you said, Star Trek and Star Wars and the rest of it. But I'm not really a huge fan of reading space opera. And yet I was really intrigued. And I really, really enjoyed this book because of the sheer sort of humanity involved in all the characters, no matter where they were from or meant to be from. How did you put together this big, diverse cast? And I mean diverse in sort of, you know, really true sense of the word, because they really are from all across the galaxy.
It was a challenge. A lot of the characters are based on people I've met, either friends or people I just crossed paths with. I had the crew figured out years before I started writing the book. And it was one of the reasons it took me such a long time to write it was I had all these characters and didn't think that I knew what to do with them. I spent a lot of time writing scenes between them, conversations between them, and didn't know how to make them fit. By the time I finally got around to writing the book, I had this box full of scraps of paper from everything from, you know, notes I was supposed to be taking in college to, you know, things I'd written on the back of receipts when I was bartending. Just all these little conversations between these people who had just stuck around with me. And I didn't think there was a story there. I was like, well, okay, it's just these people doing these things. I don't think this is a book. But the more I started looking at it, when I finally sat down, I was like, you need to do something with all of this. I realized they had a lot to do with each other. They were connected in ways I hadn't realized. At first, it was very tempting to, pick one and make a protagonist, because that's just sort of what is done. But that didn't feel right for me. I was like, well, no, it's not just about one of these people. It's about all of these people. So it was tricky finding a way to make that work. But I think in the end, it eventually, you know, became a cohesive whole.
It took
a while to get there, but
did you have a lot of lists?
Oh gosh, yes, I have more lore than I know what to do with. I have a lot of my prep work was just sitting there writing backstories for everybody. A lot of things that didn't make it into the book, but I needed to know who these people were. You know, even if they were things that the writer wasn't going to see, because there's so many characters in it and so many different species, I needed to make sure that I was staying consistent. So, yeah, I have a lot of notes on that front.
So what's next? Another novel in the works? And if so, do you think you're going to go the traditional route now?
I am working on another novel. I've only just started. I won't dive in full until this summer. It's the same universe. It's a very loose sequel. It's not a continuation of the same crew, but you will see some of the same characters. But I am staying within the same setting. And I do think I'm going to stick with the traditional route for the time being, simply because as much as I loved the self-publishing experience, and I think it's a really great option, and I think there's a lot of value in it, personally, I prefer spending my time just writing. So having a marketing team and other people to take care of the nitty gritty for me is something that appeals to me.
That sounds fantastic. So I'm looking forward to reading that.
Oh, thank you. I'm looking forward to writing it.
All right. Now, since you brought it up, one final question: Star Trek or Star Wars?
You know, I admit that. I don't think you need to pick a side. I've never understood the conflict. I grew up in a home with both, so I was unaware that there was a question until I was in middle school, and one of my classmates was like, "Well, Star Wars is better," and I was like, "No, you can have both. It's okay. You can have both." If I had to pick, if I'm forced to, if you twist my arm and make me pick, I'll go Star Trek. But I don't think you have to make that call.
Well, Becky, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.